Over the past four centuries or so, science and religion have often come into conflict. Is there any way to bring them back into harmony? Well, Stuart A. Kaufman examines the science-religion schism in his latest book, Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. Mr. Kaufman is the founding director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics and a professor at the University of Calgary. His book is published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Professor Kaufman to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
When you say reinvent the sacred, are you implying that things people think of as sacred, like God, would be reinvented?
Well,
or that they are invented?
Of course, you put your finger on precisely why the title itself is questionable. If you believe in a supernatural God, then, of course, the very notion that you would invent the sacred, as you just implied by your question, is sacrilegious. I mean, how dare you do something like that? Conversely, if you're among the billion people on the planet who don't believe in a supernatural God, we remember Galileo and the Inquisition and recanting and millions of people killed in the name of God. So the very notion of using the word sacred is horrific. So this is trying to do something new, Leonard. I'm trying to find a middle pathway between a 4,500-year-old Abrahamic tradition, let alone other traditions, the atheistic tradition. I'm trying to find a new sense of God.
A new conceptual framework of God?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think this new definition of God should encompass?
Well, let me first give credit to a Harvard theologian who's not a relative, Gordon Kaufman, who's been writing about God as the creativity in nature for about 10 to 15 years. And I came upon the idea independently out of the science that, if you want to talk about, I'll tell you about. So with Gordon, I would want to say God is the completely natural, absolutely stunning and overwhelming creativity in nature.
So God is nature, in effect, or what nature does. Isn't that what deism says?
No. Deism says God set up the universe. For example, deism was common after Newton. Mm-hmm. And the idea was God set up the universe, dialed in Newton's laws, and unleashed it, but no longer touches what's going on. But God set it all up. There is no creator in this view of God. There is, and in fact, one way of getting into this, and again, this is Gordon Kaufman's phrase, but I find myself using it as well, distinguish between the creator, God, and the creativity, say, of that creator God.
So
then the question becomes, do we actually need a creator God, or is the stunning creativity around us sufficient? And in fact, has that always been the reason we have sought a creator?
So you just throw out the whole notion of St. Thomas Aquinas of a prime mover. You're
correct.
Saying that's not needed.
Absolutely.
So why even use the word sacred here?
Well, So first of all, we need a sense of God. So I want to say that God is the creativity in nature, and the book is filled with scientific reasons why that's true, including, if I could go off on a little diatribe, is that all right, Leonard?
Please. Go where you wish. I'll follow you.
Okay. Well, a little bit about the science. We have lived for 400 years in what might be called a reductionistic worldview, which in its simplest version was stated by Simon Pierre Laplace, a French mathematician around the time of Napoleon, who said if there was an enormous intelligence that knew the positions and velocities of all the particles in the universe, that intelligence could use Newton's laws and figure out the entire future and the entire past of the universe. Now, that's reductionism in its starkest form. There's three features of it to note. First of all, it's deterministic. Because Newton's laws are deterministic.
So it says that we can predict the future.
Yeah, so we can predict the future. That gives way with quantum mechanics about a century later to the probabilistic character of quantum mechanics under the Copenhagen interpretation. The second thing about it is the following. It asserts, and I call this the Galilean spell, a belief that we've had in the West, but not in Confucian societies. We have believed since Galileo and Descartes that everything that happens in the universe is describable by natural law. The most radical thing that I say in this book is that I think that 400-year-old belief is wrong. And that, in fact, part of what unfolds in the universe cannot be described by laws. It's partially lawless, and therein is the creativity of which I'm speaking.
It's inexplicable?
It's explicable after the fact, but it's unstatable before the fact.
So we can describe it afterwards. But that's almost like saying we couldn't have predicted transistors until somebody came up with the idea of a transistor.
That's exactly what it's saying, Larry. Okay. Exactly what it's saying is that if we look at the economy, okay, let me define the adjacent possible of the economy for a moment. Okay, it's what can happen next. I'll do it in terms of a television channel changer. So in 1980, there were lots of television sets, there were lots of TV stations, there were lots of programming, and a lot of couch potatoes. So did it make sense to invent the channel changer and try to make money? Well, sure, and somebody did, and they made money. Would it have worked in North America in 1900? No, wouldn't have worked, right? Or in Europe in the year 1000? No. So what's happening, point one, is the economy and the biosphere, in a very similar way, keeps creating ever novel things, okay? And I'll call the adjacent possible that which can arise next, and you see that it changes. Now the question is, for the biosphere or for the economy, can we say ahead of time what's in the adjacent possible? And much of the book goes into saying, and we can go into it if you want to, no, we can't. For example, nobody foresaw when the computer was invented to compute the trajectories of projectiles in World War II. Nobody foresaw word processing, let alone the internet, let alone eBay, let alone Facebook. Okay, and in fact, most
and small computers,
and
because
small computers.
For a long time we imagined
the
computers.
Giant ones. Yeah, right. So, and in fact, most inventions on it are used for purposes other than that for which they were invented.
So is the economy like evolution?
Yes, except for the fact that there's human consciousness and design in the economy, and there's no reason to think the same in evolution, unless you're an intelligent design enthusiast, which I'm definitely not.
Stuart A. Kaufman's latest book is Reinventing the Sacred, The New View of Science, Reason, and Religion. It's published by Basic Books. The physicist Steven Weinberg once said that all explanatory arrows point downward. How do you think that relates to the state of scientific inquiry today?
Well said and well asked. So Weinberg's a Nobel laureate physicist. He's a reductionist. So he says explanatory arrows point downwards from societies to people, to organs, to cells, to biochemistry, to chemistry, to physics, to particle physics. And he's a very sophisticated reductionist. Murray Gell-Mann, another Nobel laureate, is a sophisticated reductionist. And I think my old friend David Gross, a recent Nobel laureate, is also a reductionist. Now, the next thing to tell you is there are two steps away from reductionism. One of them is called emergence. It's the idea that there are novel properties that cannot be explained on a reductionistic basis. Two Nobel laureate physicists, Phil Anderson and Bob Laughlin, in 1970 and just recently, have written articles and books saying reductionism isn't enough. We need emergence. A simple example from Laughlin's book is a single iron atom doesn't have rigidity, but an iron bar does. So it doesn't make sense to talk about rigidity till you've got a bar. It's an emergent property. I think that the evolution of the biosphere, Leonard, is emergent. That is to say, take your heart. I think that Weinberg could explain, and I'll get to the explanatory errors in a second. I think Weinberg, if we told him all of the constituents of your heart, could explain how your heart works. What he couldn't say are two things. He couldn't say what's the function of your heart, which is to pump blood. That's what it was selected to do, would Darwin say, right? That is to say, even if he could talk about all the causal properties of your heart, he couldn't pick out pumping blood as being particularly interesting. To do so, he'd have to become a biologist. Or he'd have to simulate the evolution of the biosphere or deduce it. Well, an argument in the book says you can't simulate it. You need an infinite number of simulations because we're on the quantum classical boundary. And then how would you confirm it? I mean, would you go back and check that this is the specific set of quantum events and cosmic rays that happen in the evolution of our biosphere. You can't do it. And I'll show you in a minute that you can't deduce it either. But now let's come back to why do the explanatory arrows not always point downward. So let's think of Darwin's notion of natural selection. Natural selection is what selected your heart. That is to say, it served to increase the fitness of an organism in some environment or set of environments. The explanatory arrows point upward to the selective environments, not downward to the underlying particles. That doesn't mean that there isn't a perfectly good causal account of how your heart works. What there isn't in physics is an account of how your heart came into existence in the universe as a complex entity via selection. Okay, so the explanatory arrows don't always point downward. And by the way, think of the channel changer. The channel changer makes sense because it's a complement to, like screw and screwdrivers are complements, precisely what we said.
But there's a difference between biology and physics. Biological phenomena may not always be predictable, but Newton's laws are reproducible, aren't
Absolutely.
They? You can move back.
Sure.
And generally you can kind of, you can prove them forward as well, can't you?
Sure, absolutely. Newton's laws are fine and we get to Jupiter using them, right? So, mm-hmm. or other places.
So it's only sometimes that these things
break down,
and other times you can be a reductionist.
I think we can be both a reductionist yet more. I'm certainly not saying that reductionism is bad. If I can tell you about Darwinian pre-adaptations, it will help explain where reductionism, the second place where reductionism fits. So the first is emergence, okay? The second is what I call breaking the Galilean spell. So it'll take a moment to tell you what a Darwinian pre-adaptation is. So we've already said what a Darwinian adaptation is. It's the pumping of blood. But then you might say to Darwin, look, my heart makes heart sounds. And he'd say, yes, that's not the function of the heart. And that's what the physicists can't distinguish, the function of the heart from things that aren't the function of the heart, like heart sounds and...
But the heart's making the sound because it's pumping. Pumps make sounds.
Yes, and it also wiggles water in your pericardial sac, and that's also not the function of the heart. It's a side effect. So Darwin's idea of a pre-adaptation is the following. There may be a causal property of a part of an organism, say heart sounds, of no use in the current environment, but there may be a different environment where it comes to be useful, so it's selected. So it's a without design, it's a pre-adaptation.
Like fish swim bladders?
Yes, like fish swim bladders that you've gotten. So for your listeners, this is a perfect example. Swim bladders are organs in certain fish that have water and air in them, and the amount of water compared to air adjusts neutral buoyancy in the water column. Here's how they are believed to have come about, according to the paleontologists. There are lungfish. In some lungfish, water got into the lungs. Now you've got a sac with water and air in it, so it's poised to become a swim bladder. And that's how it happened. Now several questions. Question one, did a new function, neutral buoyancy, come to exist in the biosphere? I think we'd both agree, yes. Did it have causal consequences for the evolution of the biosphere? Sure. New species, new proteins. Okay? Now a bunch of things follow from this. When I ask you the central question, and I'll ask the listeners too. Now that you've seen a Darwinian pre-adaptation, here's the question. Do you think you could say ahead of time what all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations are for all organisms alive now, or just for humans? So I ask you, Leonard.
I'm sure I can't.
Right. Everybody's sure we can't. That is to say, I've now asked perhaps 2,000 people. We all agree that we can't. Now pause for a moment and let's be critical. How would we prove what we're just certain of? Okay, so would we do an experiment? Well, what experiment? That doesn't make any sense. Could we prove a theorem? Conceivably, there are theorems in mathematics, like Gödel's famous incompleteness theorem, that shows that you can have statements that are true but not provable from some axioms. But in the case of Gödel, or the equivalent halting problem in computer science, there's already a mathematical framework. It's not clear to me that there's a way to mathematize the adjacent possible of the biosphere. I have no idea what mathematical structure would go on it. So now that we've said that, let's look at the next thing. We can't do what Newton told us to do. This is stunning, but we can't. Newton said, think of billiard table. Here's the billiard balls. Here's the positions and velocities. So state the variables, the billiard balls, the laws among the variables, the boundary conditions on the billiard table, and the initial conditions, namely the positions and velocities of the billiard balls, and now use Newton's magical method of fluxions or calculus to calculate the forward trajectory. Works. And it works for rockets going to Jupiter. Does it work for the emergence of swim bladders? No. And it doesn't because we don't know what the variables are ahead of time.
We will come back to that and how it applies to the basic thesis of your book, which is called Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion, published by Basic Books. My guest is Stuart A. Kaufman. Stay with us. We're back with Stuart A. Kaufman, who is the founding director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics and a professor at the University of Calgary and author of Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion, published by Basic Books. I want to go back to the things we've been discussing, but first, the kinds of objections that I would have had initially just looking at a book like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you prove your case, what does that ultimately mean? Are you going to convince somebody who is a true believer in whatever religion that that is something to be abandoned for something like this?
Can you imagine that a fundamentalist
would even be open to discussing any of these ideas?
Good chance that the answer is no. But there's a reason to say why the enterprise may be societally important. A world civilization of some kind is emerging with globalization of commerce and globalization of communications. We're crushing our civilizations together. We're retreating into fundamentalisms, often religious and often hostile. I think we have to create a safe, shared space that's sacred where we can talk to one another, use it to invent a global ethic, which we don't have now, use that global ethic to help guide us to face problems like global warming and peak oil, which is probably upon us now, which may be catastrophic. And I think that there's a race on, Leonard, between the emergence of fundamentalisms, the possibility of resource wars, and trying to, in fact, evolve our civilization fast enough to beat out what may beat us.
Well, you would object as much to the thinking of most atheists as you would to fundamentalists, wouldn't you, even though you're an atheist?
Yes. I'm not an atheist. I don't believe in God.
Well, now, what's the difference between not believing in God and being an atheist?
An atheist believes there is no God. Okay? So the whole set of categories is wrong to me. Okay? I have never believed in a supernatural God. But do I know that God doesn't exist? Of course not.
Well, and that's what an agnostic would say.
So call me an agnostic, okay? But you've asked an important question, which is if I'm a normal, say, Christian who believes in a theistic God that's omniscient, all-powerful, you know, omnipotent, all-loving, and so on, why would I care about all of this? Well, first of all, you confront the problem of evil that we all know. I mean, if it's an all-loving, all-omnipotent, all-omniscient God, how come bad things happen?
Well, of course, many people have, asked those questions and have written books about them.
Absolutely.
And there are a number of bestsellers right now by people who are asking those questions and trying to prove that there probably is no God. And it doesn't convince anybody.
Right.
And if you read the book reviews, if an atheist is reviewing Christopher Hitchens, it says, "Wow, this is brilliant."
Great.
And if a priest is reviewing it, it says, "This is terrible. The biggest nonsense I've ever read."
Right. And exactly what I think about Hitchens' book and the other books like the God Delusion and Dan Dennett's gentler book, Breaking the Spell, is they're going to be culturally useless. What I think my aim is to try to find a middle pathway. And so I'm trying to find it in where we almost got with Darwinian pre-adaptations, which is the partial lawlessness which is the creativity, I want to say, in the universe. And I want to say that that's God enough. It's a fully natural creativity in the universe. It's a very powerful image, but it's not the standard image of God.
Well, basically what you're doing is just saying, well, I'm not going to use the usual meaning of God to apply to God. I'm going to come up with another. Why not just come up with another word? I mean, why don't we just say...
No, that's a serious question. I debated quite a bit whether or not I should use the God word. There's lots of reasons not to. And maybe it's unwise, Leonard. Okay.
It's like saying, you know, a red is yeah, from now on, I believe that purple should be called red. And but all those people who are calling it red are really making a big mistake.
But let me argue with you. I mean, of course you're right. Okay, you can, in that sense, it's arbitrary. But it's not really arbitrary. First of all, our sense of God has evolved. How many gods have we worshipped in the past 100,000 years? Thousands and thousands of gods. Then Abraham came along and invented Yahweh, and our sense of God has evolved in the Abrahamic traditions from Yahweh, who was a warrior, law-giving God that created everything, but also gave us our moral law, which is, as Sam Harris points out, says, thou shalt not steal, when that meant one Israelite should not steal the slaves of a neighbor. Okay, so our sense of God has evolved and our sense of morality has evolved. Jesus as God is a very different God. It's the God is love. It's no longer even an agent. It's just love. Okay? Who says that 2,000 years later we cannot choose to evolve our sense of God again if it's a wise use of our most powerful symbol? So my answer to you is, I think we need the power of that symbol. I think we need to evolve our sense of God. But we need to evolve it away from a supernatural God to the natural creativity in the universe.
Isn't that what Buddhists are doing, and Taoists, sure, and Confucianists, mm-hmm, and all the people who don't believe in a Godhead but still have some kind of a religious sensibility?
I think that they do.
So, but this is not Buddhism or Taoism.
No, but it's
you're trying to find some kind of scientific connection.
I think that there is, and I'll tell you how it comes out, if I may. You see, we got to the point of saying we cannot pre-state Darwinian pre-adaptations in the biosphere or in the economy. That leads us to, we were almost to the point of the following. We can't do Newton. Now, if what you mean by a natural law is a law like Newton's, a compact description of the regularities of a process, which is the sensible definition of a natural law, then you can ask, is there a natural law for the emergence of swim bladders? And the answer seems to be clearly no. But that means several things. First thing it means is we've broken the Galilean spell after 400 years. It is not the case that the universe is entirely indescribable by laws, if this is right.
Which would be a mechanistic approach, no?
Well, yeah, but quantum mechanics is mechanistic only in an odd sense, okay?
Well, but quantum mechanics has all these oddities. Something's a dot, and it's also a wave particle at the same time.
Sure.
It's here and it's there all at the same time.
Yeah, right. The superposition of this probability wave in the standard interpretation of quantum mechanics. So this now leads to the notion that the evolution of at least the biosphere up to human culture is partially lawless. I think it may be true in the abiotic universe too, but I'm not prepared to argue that quite yet, and I don't in the book. I'm working on it at the quantum classical boundary. That means that there is a persistent, partially lawless becoming of the biosphere and of our culture and of our economy, which nobody's in charge of, yet it self-consistently constructs itself. Now, let's call that creativity. We can argue about the use of that term. That's Gordon Kaufman's creativity. It's now our choice whether or not we want to use the God word to refer to that fully natural creativity. And I think it's a good idea. In fact, I think it's important because it carries such emotive power. So watch how it invites a sense of the sacred. And I'll just give it to you in a personal story. I live outside of Calgary in a little town called Bragg Creek. There's a gorgeous hill across from the house with spruce and aspen on it. And one day last summer, I was looking at it, and I thought to myself, with my sense of God, I could cut down those trees if I wanted to. But they're God's work. I better have a very good reason. How dare I? Then I looked at the little stream, and I said I could dam that stream. And then I thought, but that's God's work. I better have a very good reason to do so. So this view of the creativity in nature, just creativity, okay, invites awe, reverence, membership, responsibility. So I think it helps us construct a sacred which becomes all of life in the planet, and then into a global ethic. Now there's another direction to mention that's equally important. If we do not know what's going to happen, then reason, the highest virtue of the human mind in the Enlightenment, is an insufficient guide to living our lives. But that means we have to reunite our entire humanity. Reason, emotion, intuition, the whole thing. But that means understanding things in a united way about how we manage to live not knowing. We all know that we do. It's just that we never talk about it.
Well, you write that we need a world in which brute facts yield values.
Also.
Why do we need that?
Well, in physics...
And what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that's the following. In physics, there are only happenings. Okay, balls roll down hills. Right now, you're doing something. You're interviewing me. This is a doing. There are no doings in physics. There are only happenings. Where do doings come from? And the answer is agency. You're an agent, and I'm an agent. And so I talk about what's the minimum thing that you can have to be an agent. Now, once you've got an agent, you've got values.
But you say bacterium have agency.
Yes, I do.
You might want to argue. Bacterium have values?
I would say,
let's infect this guy?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to attribute consciousness to a bacterium. And we might argue with one another about whether agency requires consciousness. But in any case, agency has come to exist in the universe. It really has come to exist. We're agents. And maybe bacteria are agents. I want to believe yes, but maybe not. In any case, it leads in interesting directions. But notice that you can't get to agency. You can't get to life. You can't get to biology from physics. Therefore, you can't get to agency from physics.
But when you talk about values, what do you mean? You're not talking about the family values that many politicians base their votes in Congress on.
No, I'm talking about something much deeper. Where does value come into a universe that is devoid of value if it's just a world of physical fact? And the answer is you need agency from which you get values. So deer have values, gophers have values, bugs have values, and so do we.
And not cutting down that tree is a reflection of your values.
Correct. Right. And so you get to an ought. You get to ought, so you get to morals, you get to ethics. All flows from this.
Because that's one of the big arguments of religious people against non-belief, that there are that you don't have values if you don't have
correct.
Some...
That's right. But yet it's wrong. That in the following sense. If you look at the great apes, chimps and capuchin monkeys show rudimentary morality, probably because of group selection, not individual selection. Therefore, evolution is the first source of our morality, not its enemy.
My guest is Stuart A. Kaufman, who's written a book called Reinventing the Sacred. It's published by Basic Books. But I'm sure you've read the polls. Current recent polls show that a majority of Americans, 51%, according to CBS News, do not believe in evolution.
That's right. And
that's down from 54% not long ago.
Right. And I'm living in Canada right now. The United States, interestingly, is the most religious of the first world nations. More people believe in angels. More people believe in God. And fewer people believe in evolution. They're wrong, certainly about evolution.
But why do you think that is? And why do you think it's so typically American?
I don't know why it's typically American at all, Leonard.
But because we're a country that has never had an official religion?
That might be.
that separation of church and state actually has led to more religiosity?
I think it might be the case that that's true, because states that have a state religion in general ignore it in a secular age. But meanwhile, what's, I think, lying behind the resistance to evolution is a deep cultural fear. The fear is that without God to be author of our morality, Western civilization will crumble. That's what's lying behind it. But it's a mistaken fear. It won't crumble. We're moral because we evolved to be moral, and meanwhile we're biohistorical creatures, to use Gordon Kaufman's fine phrase, and we've evolved our sense of morals. We no longer would hold moral what we did 4,000 years ago.
Bringing up the Nobel Prize-winning physicist we discussed earlier, Steven Weinberg, he said the more we comprehend the universe, the more pointless it seems.
Yes, but he's a reductionist. If you're not a reductionist, if you live in a world of emergence, if you live in a... See, there's another feature of Laplace's reductionism that I didn't quite get to. It's the nothing but view of reductionism, that the universe is nothing but particles in motion. So organisms are not real. They're just particles in motion. A couple in love on the banks of the Seine is not real. That view, I believe, is wrong. And a simple example of it is the following. Most complex things above the level of the atom will never get to exist in the history of the universe. Your heart exists. It's complex. It's a specific organization of structure and process that pumps blood. A physicist could explain it, given it. Couldn't explain its coming about. Therefore, it is what is called epistemologically and ontologically real. Epistemologically means what you can know, and ontologically means what's really there. Things that have causal consequences, like hearts, that cannot be deduced from physics, are real in their own right. Hearts are real, and a couple in love is real. And so Weinberg's wrong, because the couple in love certainly has values, namely one another, okay? So the universe isn't meaningless. We're in it.
You advocate a reemphasis on teaching the humanities and arts. How do you think the humanities are treated on most college campuses today?
I may be mistaken about this, Leonard, but here's my sense. Christian Book, as a good friend up in Calgary, he's a prize-winning Canadian poet, and he has studied how poetry has responded to science since Newton. Basically, poetry has bounced off the wall of science for 400 years or 350 years, adoring science, hating science, lamenting science, saying science gives no values, but poetry can give us values.
Conversely, Newton's described poetry as indigenous nonsense.
Right. Okay. He did indeed. And now we come to the point, okay? If we don't know what's going to happen, and we have to use reason, intuition, emotion, all of our humanity, to know how we live in a world when we don't know what's going to happen, acting as Kierkegaard said, or as Nietzsche said, as if we know, or as Kierkegaard said, living our lives forward when we don't know. Think of being a CEO of a company. You don't know what's going to happen. We need all we've got. And I think that means we need to reunite the sciences and the humanities and much more. We need to reunite our whole humanity and the ways that we live in a world that we don't understand. And that also means, you see, when reductionism seemed enough, we thought we knew with Weinberg what the explanation would look like. Everything would be reduced to particle physics. If that's wrong, if emergence is real and breaking the Galilean spell is real, and part of what's going on is lawless, even though nitrogen can't change to carbon, that's still lawful, then we have to rethink everything. I think we need a new enlightenment. I think we really have to rethink everything we've thought.
Stuart A. Kaufman's latest book, Reinventing the Sacred, A New View of Science, Reason, and Religion, is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, Richard Clark, former White House counterterrorism advisor, on how our government can break the cycle of national security disasters. Also, the fascinating story of a 1930s diary that was discovered in a dumpster on the Upper West Side, the memoirs of one of Manhattan's most respected wine merchants, and Rick Moonen and Ruth Reichel on how to become an eco-conscious cook. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs and Jennifer Poyant. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. Thanks for listening. Hope you're having a great Memorial Day. See you tomorrow.